Funding for Think comes from SMU's Continuing and Professional Education, presenting Secrets from the White House.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Will South Africa reach the potential imagined by the world in the heady days of 1994? The country's relatively peaceful transition from the injustices of apartheid to majority rule remains a crowning achievement of 20th century democracy. 13 years after the departure of Nelson Mandela, a generation is coming of age with no personal memories of the days before the law promised them equal rights, regardless of race or ethnicity. And yet it remains clear that many of their parents' and grandparents' visions of economic justice and equal opportunity remain unfulfilled. Douglas Foster is associate professor at the Medill School of Journalism and former editor of Mother Jones magazine. He has worked and traveled extensively in South Africa and shares what he's learned in his new book, After Mandela, The Struggle for Freedom in Post-Apartheid South Africa. Douglas, welcome to Think.
Good to be with you, Chris.
We'll talk shortly about the recent unrest among platinum miners and the subsequent massacre by police in South Africa. But those events notwithstanding, can you talk about why South Africa has received relatively little global attention since the end of apartheid?
I think it's about us, journalists. We understand two narratives, by and large. We understand the miracle, and that was what drew us so powerfully to the story of Nelson Mandela coming out of prison after 27 years, becoming the first black elected president in this new democracy. And then when he stepped down as president, the country went off our radar, frankly, I think. So we understand that narrative. We understand the cataclysm narrative, which takes up much of the reporting about Africa. If there's a disaster, a catastrophe, a massacre, we know that narrative. But the more complicated one of a people attempting to overcome centuries of colonization and then 50 years of this peculiar and very extreme form of racial segregation known as apartheid, struggling to find the wiggle room to create the non-racial, non-sexist, and non-homophobic egalitarian society that was promised by Mandela in 1994, that's a more complicated story, and it's harder for us to focus our attention on that one. And that's the gap that this book that I've finished attempts to fill.
And we definitely get the sense that South Africa today is not a disaster, and it is certainly not miraculous. It is a country striving day to day to figure things out into the future.
You've got that exactly right. And I think if we look back at what the ANC, the African National Congress, the governing party, inherited in the mid-90s, it's understandable that it would be no easy matter to arrive at that goal because on the day that democracy arrived in 1994 in that first election in which the black majority, 80% of the population, was allowed to vote, two other world historic forces walked in the door at the same time. And the one was linking up the economy to a rapidly changing global capitalist economy, and HIV, the pandemic arriving virtually at the same moment. So you had these tremendous cross currents arriving at the same time. And that at least puts into context why 18 years later there should be such a large gap between what was promised and what has been delivered so far.
Help us understand the scope and the dominance of the ANC within South Africa, because it is not simply the majority party. For all intents and purposes, it is the party.
Well, I call it the governing party. It got 62% and a half percent of the vote under Mandela. It became a more than two-thirds in national elections in 2004. And since, under President Zuma, the latest national election fell back to about 64%. So it's not the only party operating, but it certainly sets the agenda. And that's what we've seen elsewhere in Africa, where a liberation party, a party that is given credit by the vast majority for having created change, gets that kind of residual loyalty, if I can put it that way, and the ANC still has that hold. But the activity of the other parties is not, they don't pose an immediate threat of being able to win in a national election, but they can't be entirely counted out. For example, the Democratic Alliance, the main opposition party, holds power of provincial government in the Western Cape, where Cape Town is. And that's nothing to be sniffed at. One out of nine is not an even game, but certainly does hold real power in that province.
So Nelson Mandela is viewed in many parts of the world as a sort of living saint, but in one area in which we know he clearly failed to act effectively was in stemming the spread of HIV in South Africa, despite losing two sons himself over the course of his life to AIDS. Can you talk about what caused him to miss this issue?
Yeah, it's really not so hard to talk about this in the South African context because there's nobody more critical of Nelson Mandela on this score than Nelson Mandela. He's often said that if he ends up in, as he says, the other place rather than heaven, it will be because he missed the opportunity to make a difference on HIV when he was president from 1994 to 1999. That is when the HIV tipped into epidemic proportions in the country. I think it's, I don't make any apology for him, but I think it's explainable if you go back to that moment when he took over as the first elected black president in a country where the economy was imploding, where lots of people were coming back from exile, where there were very basic questions about whether a majority black government, an ANC-led government, could manage the largest economy in Africa. And I think that this is one of the one of those tragic cases where the immediate crises drove out the important. I think in addition to that, if you kind of roll the time capsule back and also think about the way in which other countries responded in the early stages of HIV, in many other parts of the world, the effects of the epidemic were localized in a way to specific communities. This is the one place where it spilled into a generalizable epidemic that was spread primarily through heterosexual sex. And I think all of the fault lines that HIV, that the epidemic has exposed around the world, of a special stigma attached to a sexually transmissible disease, was magnified in the South African context at a point when public leaders were being pulled in so many other directions. And so, like I say, Nelson Mandela is as critical of himself as anybody else.
It does, you know, looking back on this history causes you that sort of agonizing wonder of what South Africa would look like today if the timing had not been as it was, if the epidemic hadn't been at its, you know, at its apex, essentially, at the time that South Africa was achieving its freedom.
You're right about that, Chris. I mean, if we accept the idea of contingency in history, meaning that things happened that didn't have to happen, there are a lot of things in this area that I think historians look at, think about, and speculate about. I mean, among other things, if Nelson Mandela and the leadership that then come out of prison and come back from exile to run the country had not been held away from those positions for 30 years, if you imagine, you know, even a 10-year run for Nelson Mandela as a younger man coming back into office before these other crises hit, you can imagine a closing of the gap between the promise of the revolution and what's been achieved that would be a lot more happy story to tell.
And instead what happened was Mandela completed a single five-year term, was succeeded by Thabo Mbeki, who famously rejected the science linking HIV to active AIDS infection.
That's right. He didn't believe that HIV led to AIDS. and he was singularly responsible for a government policy that delayed and subverted a meaningful prevention and treatment policy. I mean, HIV experts from around the world know that you need both ends of that policy to make an effect, especially with a situation in which new infections were out of control until recently.
What role have NGOs played in, as compared with the South African government, in getting a handle on the AIDS crisis and in providing care for those in need?
Well, I think the NGOs like Medicine Sans Frontières, Doctors Without Borders, had an incredible impact early on. They were the organization that was providing treatment before 2004 when the government began to provide antiretroviral treatment in public health clinics. In addition to that, there was a mass organizing by civic institutions, organizations like the Treatment Action Campaign that were tremendously influential. And then there are all the quiet, unheralded heroes and heroines who didn't make headlines, including doctors, community health workers, and those kinds of people who I profile in the book, who did just amazing work against terrible odds in terms of the scope of the pandemic, but also given that there wasn't adequate government support until relatively recently.
What options are available today, Douglas, for South Africans who find themselves HIV positive in terms of access to care, and is that care contingent on their income level and their ability to pay?
Well, I think the big strength of the South African politics and society now is that the focus is so much on what's happening to people at the bottom. So care is available, including provision of antiretrovirals in public health clinics, both community clinics and major hospitals. Access has been drastically improved under the current administration since 2008. There's a quite visionary Minister of Health in office who's made a tremendous difference. That doesn't mean that everybody who needs treatment gets it, far from it, but huge strides made in the last 3 years, 3 or 4 years.
And what about the access in rural areas as compared with urban ones?
That's the tricky part, is having a well-rounded public health policy that looks equal wherever in the country you are. There are some places where the access to antiretrovirals is spotty. There's some places, as the Minister of Health said in his most recent speech to the National Assembly, where there's good provision of antiretrovirals, but not provision of other medications. So I think it is a struggle, a tremendous strain in a public health system that was inadequate when the current government took over to get the balance right.
Douglas Foster is my guest. He's associate professor at the Medill School of Journalism and former editor of Mother Jones magazine. His new book is called After Mandela, The Struggle for Freedom in Post-Apartheid South Africa. You can join the conversation by sending email to think@kera.org or by calling us at 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education, presenting Secrets from the White House Kitchen, lecture, book signing, and hors d'oeuvres, October 16th with Chef John Hanney III. More at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is associate professor at the Medill School of Journalism and former editor of Mother Jones magazine, Douglas Foster. His new book is called After Mandela, The Struggle for Freedom in Post-Apartheid South Africa. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372 or by sending email to think@kera.org. I want to talk, Douglas, about the economic realities of modern South Africa. It's such an interesting situation that the black majority clearly holds a great deal of political influence, but a lot of the country's wealth remains concentrated with the white minority. Can you talk about how that affects the practical division of power in the country?
Yeah, that's right. And I think that among the things we were talking about earlier in terms of how we understand this gap between what was promised and what's been achieved is that essentially in 1994, the liberation movement led by the African National Congress traded away, in some senses, the right to restructure the economy, to redistribute wealth, and so on, in exchange for the vote. As a result of that, 18 years later, particularly young people, this is a very young society. Half the population is 24 and under. 40% of the population is 18 and under. You'll hear people in the townships and some of the people I interviewed saying, the ANC is in office, but not in power. And I think that's a really challenging formulation down the road, because if people at some point begin to think that political exercise of the political franchise doesn't matter because it hasn't had the effect of yielding social justice or economic freedom, that's a very fundamental challenge potentially to the success of this experiment. 80% of the wealth is still held in the hands of whites. 80% of the land is still in white hands.
So it's directly opposite, inversely proportionate to the population.
Correct.
Situation.
Correct, mm-hmm. Because it's about 9% of the population is white. So that's obviously not sustainable to continue basically apartheid era situation in which class and race is so tightly intertwined. Now, at the same time, 2 million people have been, 2 million blacks have been moved into the ranks of middle-income earning citizens of South Africa. So people understand that that kind of social mobility is necessary. They've seen examples of it, but in a population of 50 million, not enough.
Is that in part due to, maybe now school systems and education is equalizing, but there is a generation of sort of middle-aged adults who weren't privy to the kinds of reforms that their children have enjoyed?
Absolutely. It's the sins of apartheid experienced in present-day South Africa, in the sense that since 1948 through 1990, the educational system was really organized to produce only two outcomes for black students, and that was to prepare women to be domestic workers and men to be laborers or mine workers. And so that is a very tough thing to change. And the ANC has been particularly ineffective in creating particularly a primary education system that turns that around quickly enough so that you have a match between what people are being educated to do and the jobs that will be available to them. The most disturbing thing that I saw recently included in the last chapter of the book is an indication that very large numbers of black graduates from college are not finding jobs in their first year, and that tells you that the system is really out of whack, because there is a deep hunger, I think, on the corporate and business side to begin to much more quickly integrate not just the ranks of ordinary workers, but their executive ranks as well.
So the reports out of South Africa this past summer of the massacre at the Platinum Mine were just shocking. The thought of this, was it 44 miners who were killed?
34 in the shooting, but I think the death toll at Marikana itself is now up to about 45 or 46.
Mm. So give us some background as to what the grievances were and why this protest devolved into violence.
Yeah, I think that it's an example of everything we've been talking about, an understanding of a worker. This was a wildcat strike at Lonmin by workers who do actually quite highly skilled work. They're called rock drillers, down in the deepest shafts in those mines. They went on a wildcat strike because they said that they were being driven into penury by their wage levels. They're by no means the lowest paid workers in South Africa. In fact, they are part of the class that's being lofted into middle income status, but they did not feel that their union was representing their demands with enough vigor, and they broke off and did a wildcat in association with an alternative union. Strikes in South Africa are often quite violent, and this one had been so. 10 people had died on both sides of the strike line up to the massacre. But on last month, 34 wildcat strikers were shot down and killed by the People's Police. And it led not just to consternation around the world, but an ongoing kind of soul-searching within the governing party and inside South Africa about how it could happen that 18 years after the country's supposed liberation, the People's Police would shoot strikers, some of them in the back.
But is it safe to say that this was emblematic of labor relations throughout the country?
I do think labor relations in general are at a very low ebb. You see it in the fact that in some ways the Lonmin strike was a copycat strike of another strike in a mine that had also been a wildcat and where workers had been successful in getting a wage increase, and the entire mining industry is being rocked now by copycats from Lonmin. So you see this example of the, you know, highly skilled, very important workforce bringing the country to the edge of very serious economic consequences.
Half of the population of South Africa, as you mentioned, is 24 or under.
Yes.
How politically active is this new generation of very young adults?
Well, I think they're politically savvy in ways that surprised me. I did group interviews all over the country, so I would go to the north of the country where people would tell me young people are disaffected, they're not involved in party structures, et cetera. They don't know anything about the history of the country, and they're not engaged. I went to township schools and elementary schools in the cities, in Johannesburg, Durban, and Cape Town. I found young people of that age intensely engaged, but also quite suspicious of whether putting their energy into traditional political forms, joining the ANC Youth League, for example, would adequately represent their interests. So I think we see their involvement as not being directed so much at electoral matters. After all, until they're 18, they can't vote. But I do see them intensely engaged in HIV prevention, in economic development projects. And overall, they, in surveys, they're quite optimistic about the future. The last survey I saw showed that young South Africans were among the most optimistic young people in the world, which, given what we've just said about the objective conditions, might surprise you. 57% said they expected their life would be better than their parents. We don't get those kind of survey results in the United States or in Europe these days, for example. So it's a mixed bag. I would say a lot of questioning about whether the trade-off that the ANC made in 1994 was the right one, and certainly a lot of concern about when political liberation will lead to economic freedom.
I mean, how protectionist do you see the white minority being of their wealth and of the remaining power that they have?
Well, I think the results tell you something.
Mm-hmm.
18 years, with all of the pressure that was brought by successive governments to integrate executive ranks, to engage with black partners, to have as part of your business activity a social and community development component. There are many, many, many individuals and companies, of course, who have risen to the challenge, but you can't look at that continuing hold on wealth and power being so tightly circumscribed by race as a fair outcome unless you begin with a racist assumption. So I think the proof is in the pudding on that question.
There are people who are concerned that there will be violence at the moment of Nelson Mandela's death. What accounts for that fear, and is it valid?
I don't think it is valid, but I think I understand where it comes from, particularly if you monitor, as I occasionally do, the websites of right-wing whites. I think it goes like this. They were raised for generations to believe that there were two major threats in life, the red menace and the black menace.
Hmm.
And then political liberation happened, and it happened on the backs largely of black people and mixed-race people called coloreds, and it didn't happen. And this man, Nelson Mandela, that they had been told over and over again for generations and by their parents and grandparents was a terrorist, was a communist, whose rise to power would coincide with a mass slaughter of whites. That didn't happen. So where would the fear go? It would go to the idea that once he was gone, there was one good black leader who was protecting them from that outcome. Now, in fairness to even these very extreme right-wing whites, I think the other source of the fear is the ongoing very high rates of violent crime. And even though the effect of a very high murder rate and robbery rate is felt disproportionately by blacks, the end of apartheid did mean that whites were subject to conditions that were closer to the conditions that had been suffered by their fellow citizens. So I think those two sources, a kind of residual impulsive sense that the rise of a black political politicians and the control of blacks over politics would necessarily be a threat to life and limb, and then the high crime rate both.
Let's go to the phones now at 1-800-933-5372. We have PJ on the line in Bedford. Hello, PJ.
Oh, thank you. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I wanted to see if your guest has any comments regarding this particular young politician by the name Julius Malema. And sort of the influence that Zimbabwean politics, because he's closely associated with, or at least has been in touch with ZANU-PF, which is Zimbabwe's, we know, which is a Zimbabwean political party. And I wanted to see sort of the influence and what that sentiment within South Africa, if it's sort of going to fall along the lines of what happened in Zimbabwe when they took over, land redistribution and stuff like that. And I'll take my answer there.
Thanks for your call, BJ.
I was going to ask BJ where he was from, because that's a Durban accent, but we'll see. So I'll take them in reverse order. The fear that South Africa is going the way of Zimbabwe, which I think is felt pretty intensely among whites, and I would say mixed race people, colored, classified colored under apartheid in the Western Cape. I don't think it has a lot of validity, but I understand the fear. Zimbabwe is on the northern border. The former president, President Mbeki, was seen as somebody in what was dubbed the quietly diplomacy as an enabler of the dictator there, Robert Mugabe. And so I think there was this sense that why is he protecting him, and are there signs that the ANC would go the way of ZANU-PF? I don't think you see anything like the cult of personality in ZANU-PF in the ANC. Partly, you know, Chris, what you said at the opening of the conversation, Nelson Mandela served one term. He handed over power to his successor after one term. His successor, President Mbeki, was recalled by his party and taken out of office in 2008. So we've had really three major changes and shifts in power, successions of peaceful power, peaceful successions in just 18 years, and of course that has never happened in Zimbabwe. So I don't think see conditions under which South Africa would go the Zimbabwe way. I just don't. But I do know that it's something that after a few drinks people will say in a bar all the time. On Julius Malema, he makes headlines. He certainly, since he was expelled from the African National Congress, he's the former youth leader of the African National Congress, has been traveling around the country calling for a new revolution. I think the extent to which he has any traction is because he's giving voice to an anguish from the working poor and poor people, particularly in rural areas, about this gap we've been discussing. I think whether he has traction going forward as a political leader, either outside the ANC or inside, depends a lot on what this current leadership, how this current leadership reflects on what happened in the mines and is happening, and what they do in order to recapture the momentum, recapture the sense that the ANC really does continue to have its historic, quote, bias towards the poor, unquote, which is part of its identity.
Douglas Foster is my guest. He's associate professor at the Medill School of Journalism and former editor of Mother Jones magazine. His new book is called After Mandela, The Struggle for Freedom in Post-Apartheid South Africa. Join this conversation by calling in to 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education, presenting Secrets from the White House Kitchen, lecture, book signing, and hors d'oeuvres, October 16th with Chef John Hanney III. More at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Douglas Foster. He's associate professor at the Medill School of Journalism and former editor of Mother Jones magazine. His new book is called After Mandela, The Struggle for Freedom in Post-Apartheid South Africa. Our telephone number is 1-800-933-5372. Email address is think@kera.org. Douglas, how free is the media in South Africa to say and do what it pleases?
It's, the country has a tremendous strength in press freedoms, but they're under question and under attack, including with a bill that's currently in Parliament called the Protection of State Information Act. It's something I actually had a direct argument with President Zuma about in my last interview with him. And I think it is troubling that the African National Congress continues to feel so burdened by a critical press, critical, independent, and questioning press. So I would say it's remarkably free, given the kind of coverage that has taken place in the last 18 years. And it's one of those things you want to keep an eye on, and luckily there's a robust press that can stand up for itself. There's also a robust group of civic organizations who are quite vocal in standing up for media freedoms.
Are the media in South Africa controlled by a sort of demographically representative sample of the population?
No, but it's probably more transformed than other sectors of the economy, in the sense that black economic empowerment companies have taken more of a role in ownership. You've also seen a very quickly changing newsroom. It's one of the things that struck me the most when I first started going in 2004, was the extent to which these journalists coming from communities that hadn't been represented in media operations before, covering the transformation that they were also part of in their newsroom. So, in other words, you'd be in a newsroom where some of the editors could remember the apartheid era signs about which entrance should be used by colored employees and which by whites, and where whites and blacks needed to sit separately, to very integrated newsrooms in which people of color, blacks and colors are represented at every level, including as executive producers in major outlets and as editors-in-chief.
How comfortable socially are South Africans in terms of mixing racially? Is that a generational thing?
Yeah, I think it's partly generational. And you know, I would have, particularly when I talk to mixed groups about this, they would say, you know, I've never seen people so unwilling or unable to talk across racial lines as when I visited the U.S. So it's a kind of useful corrective to only be looking at it in one direction. But I think there are, you know, because apartheid is so recent, the strictures of apartheid are so recent, where until so recently, the law prescribed where black people could go, who they could marry, and essentially classified them as not citizens in their own land. There is a kind of edge and residue of that kind of uncertainty about how sustainable the new order is, and I think as a result of that, people occasionally have these much-needed conversations that where people are really saying what's happening them across those lines. But I think it's tentative, in the same way that you may see here, people beginning to broach a subject and then not fully expressing what they're actually thinking.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go to Bob in Granbury. Hello, Bob.
Hi there, Chris. It's Bob Garrett, a friend of Doug's, and I wanted to just compliment you on your selection of a guest. He is a great journalist and human being, Doug Foster.
Well, we're happy to have him as well.
It's going to be hard to argue with that, Bob.
I do have a question, and pardon me if I missed it. I was... what is the status of Jacob Zuma's criminal problems, and what is his political standing now?
We haven't talked about that yet, so thanks for asking.
Sure. Thanks for the question. Zuma's charges, there were two major problems that he had before he became president. One was a formal charge of corruption, bribery, and tax evasion. The other was a trial on a rape allegation. The rape charge was tried, a very embarrassing trial for him, and he was acquitted. The corruption charges were dropped on the eve of the national election in 2009, and there is an investigation ongoing under which they might be revived. I think the odds are low that would happen. But he certainly did, you know, as deputy president, had a cloud hanging over him on corruption allegations and lost his job as deputy president, was fired by former President Mbeki, largely as a result of those. His standing right now is that he is up for election along with the other five top leaders of the ANC at their national conference in December. And I think if the information I'm getting just in the last few hours is correct, he's got a real run on his hands. It's possible that a major challenge will be mounted against him by his own deputy president, and I think it could be another very, very tough fight for those top positions.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's go next to Marshall in Dallas. Hey, Marshall.
Hi. I have been reading Mother Jones off and on ever since it came out, and I also read a publication called the London Review of Books, which is at least as left-wing as Mother Jones. And there was a report in there either earlier this year or last year that said that there was a move by some in the ANC to have tens of thousands of the mixed race or colored people fired from good jobs so that blacks can get those jobs. Do you have a comment about that?
Yeah, I didn't see that piece, so I can't really comment on that. I don't. It sounds wrong, that scale of it, but I think there is an ongoing tension between mixed race or colored people, particularly in the Western Cape, and blacks over the scope and scale of affirmative action. In other words, the policies that have been put into place to try to level the playing field based on the patterns of previous discrimination mean that many of those policies will go more directly to benefiting blacks. And I think there's been some kickback from that among coloreds. And I think there's a bit of a feeling among coloreds who were privileged over blacks under apartheid, that they were not white enough under apartheid and maybe not black enough now in the post-apartheid period. So I think there are tensions along those lines. One of the really challenging things about the book was to try to get into these details about race. South Africa has so often been reported as if it ought to, the racial differences or the ethnic differences ought to be reported across lines of white and black when, you know, less than 10% of the population is white. So we've got 11 major official language groups, and among those groups are differences worth exploring and understanding, and certainly this is one of the big ones. I haven't read the London Review of Books piece, but your summary of it doesn't sound right. I don't think anybody could point to a policy of the ANC to privilege blacks over coloreds in that way.
Do you find that some of the importance of those ethnic differences tends to fall away when younger people leave the rural areas where they are really surrounded by a sort of local, cultural, and tribal outlook and move into cities?
You know, absolutely. I think that they're not just into cities, but to informal settlements or townships, where you know, your neighbor might speak another language, or where the kid you're playing with might have a Zulu-speaking and Xhosa-speaking parents, crossing those lines. So certainly, it happens in the peri-urban, peri-rural areas, and also small towns along the way in that migration from traditional homelands to a more cosmopolitan identity. And certainly the surveys of young people show an increasing number of people, if you ask, who are you, traditionally in South Africa might be, when I asked Jacob Zuma that question, he said, I am Jacob Zuma, I come from Inkandla. The tendency would be to name the village where you were born, to retain that identity as a prime identity in your life. Rising numbers of young people say, I am, you know, name themselves a South African. Mm-hmm. So I think national identity and a sense of nationhood that melds these language groups and ethnic groups is certainly on the rise in everything that I've seen.
And that phenomenon has been an issue even within Nelson Mandela's own family among his grandsons.
Sure. I mean, the grandkids largely grew up in Soweto in the township until they were taken into his home after he was released. And Nelson Mandela's son Makoto was married to a non-Xhosa speaker. So absolutely, they are representative of that kind of cross-ethnic, hybridizing, modernizing, cosmopolitan African identity. It's not a matter of South African values versus Western values. There's a very strong sense of being African, but kind of hybridized and not hived off quite in the ways that people were by design under apartheid. 80% of the population was squeezed into 13% of the land in areas, so-called homelands, where it was homogenous in terms of language and identity.
Would South Africa, in the opinion of you and other observers, be better off if Jacob Zuma were to leave the presidency and either his deputy president or someone else were to take over that role?
Boy, that's a tough one, because I'm always reluctant as a journalist and as an outsider to think about even who I would vote for in a situation like that. I do think that there are many challenges. Certainly the young people I'm in touch with, these dozens and hundreds of informants that I stay in touch with now, even since finishing the book, even those who were very strong supporters of Zuma until recently have begun to wonder whether he's the person, a 70-year-old man, to take South Africa into its future. I think that the terms of the debate leading up to the end of December, when this will be decided within the party, is being argued along those lines. Is he up to 5 more years? Is what he's accomplished and not accomplished since he became president of the country in 2009 an adequate measure of where he would take the country? And I think it's even odds that the younger delegates to the African National Congress National Conference will vote against him.
Douglas Foster is associate professor at the Medill School of Journalism and former editor of Mother Jones magazine. His new book is called After Mandela, The Struggle for Freedom in Post-Apartheid South Africa. Douglas, it's been such an interesting hour. Thank you so much for spending it with us.
Those were great questions, Chris. I like the callers, too. Thanks a lot.
Today's show was engineered by Shelley Canavy. Joe Bilotti answers the phones. Christine McConnell produces the podcast. Jeff Whittington is our senior producer. Learn more about Think, find out about upcoming programs, and download the podcast every day free at kera.org/think. Email comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.